everybody, and welcome to Endpoint Enigma. I'm your host, Hank Schless, and we have some pretty cool stuff lined up for you guys today. We're actually going to take a deep dive into the Uyghur surveillance campaigns that the Lookout Threat Research Team discovered and released back in July. We got a fair amount of coverage out of that, which was very cool. It was reported on extensively, including by the New York Times and a few other major newspapers. And so joining us from that team, we have Apurva Kumar and Kristen Del Russo, two of our security intel engineers who actually discovered the surveillanceware behind this Chinese campaign. So welcome, Apurva and Kristen.
Thank you.
Hey, Hank.
Glad to have you both. And also, as part of this threat research special, we're going to have veteran security reporter Lindsay O'Donnell from ThreatPost. Lindsay has covered countless threat discoveries, including many by Lookout. So thanks for taking the time to join us here, Lindsay.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. So before we get going and really dive into the surveillanceware campaigns, part of the reason we wanted you on here, Lindsay, is to provide us with some of the media's perspective. You know, you see a lot, you talk to people all day, every day. So what are some of the mobile security trends that you're seeing lately?
From a mobile perspective, like you said, there is a ton of activity going on, and we do a ton of that coverage at ThreatPost. And it seems like there's a story every day, whether it's, you know, malicious apps or mobile malware. So I would say that we're seeing two big trends from my perspective. The first is that we're really seeing APTs going all in on mobile malware, which makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, we've seen a huge rise in mobile use by end users. So that's going to be very lucrative. We're seeing nation state groups operating in, you know, China, North Korea, Russia. They're all shifting their malware development focus from the desktop to instead target mobile users for intelligence gathering, financial gain, and disruption of national rivals. And a big part of that is spyware and surveillanceware. A ton of researchers who I've talked to have said that that shift to specifically target mobile users really reflects the fact that the quality of the information that is offered up is top tier in terms of geolocation data, emails, messaging content, device info, you know, contact information, and more. The second thing that I'm seeing from my perspective is how sophisticated mobile remote access Trojans or rats are becoming available more to these types of nation state attackers via commercial services. So, you know, we've heard a lot about NSO Group and Pegasus spyware, and that's really part of this trend too, in terms of selling spyware as a commercial service. So what that means is that they're continually maintaining and patching their malware and producing new variants. So right now, this is becoming vastly more sophisticated on the attacker level, and it's extremely lucrative for bad actors.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those advanced persistent threats or APTs are definitely something we're seeing a lot. You know, from our perspective, helping people understand that these mobile devices have just as much access to sensitive data and honestly have more about us or our company than a laptop or any other endpoint. So, Kristen, I guess something I would pose to you is, you know, what is it that makes mobile devices so attractive and so lucrative for malicious actors?
Yeah, well, I think you hit one of the key points right on the head right there is it's not a desktop or even a laptop that I'm leaving in the office. You know, my phone is always with me in my back pocket, in my purse, wherever it might be. Even at nighttime, I don't ever turn it off. I just leave it to charge on my bedside table on Do Not Disturb. And, you know, like Lindsay said, in terms of the data on it, it's just so immensely valuable. It is like any spy's dream to get what's on there, because not only do you have your conversations, your phone calls, your GPS location, but you have very intimate details. So, you know, shared photo albums, you know, personal text messages, your social media accounts, your payment information, your banking logins. So it is just an absolute wealth of information that you might not even have on a corporate desktop, because people will use their phone for literally everything.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, all that stuff. And to your point, even when we are not using it, it's still there. Like you said, when, you know, you're asleep and it's right next to you, it's still on. You know, all of this is probably why threat actors like, you know, the Chinese groups behind what we discovered recently target this stuff. So, Apurva, for those who aren't quite as familiar with this research. Can you give a little bit of a summary on what the threat intelligence team discovered?
Sure, yeah. So I guess to start with a little bit of background, in this report, we basically provide details on four surveillanceware or spyware families that actually have not been publicly spoken about. They are long-running families, a lot of them. We've been tracking them for some time. And they mostly target the Uyghur population, as you mentioned, but they also target Tibetan communities. So there's a certain couple of groups of interest for them. They're also all connected with each other. So basically, in a typical spyware, the malware will call back to a command and control infrastructure, so a domain or an IP address, some location on the internet to send back the sensitive personal data that it wants to exfiltrate. And so all of these four surveillanceware families that we discuss are connected through similar command and control infrastructure, as well as other hallmarks, which we define basically as being the same threat actor. So it appears to us that they have overlaps in signing certificates, which suggests it is the same developer or the same operator behind these families. And then specifically about just the way that they operate, two of the families, Silk Bean and Double Agent, are remote access Trojans. So these are not just surveillanceware. They basically allows you to execute any kind of arbitrary commands on the device and gives you just a much further detailed access into an infected device and the victim.
Got it. And yeah, Lindsay, you actually mentioned rats earlier when you were talking about the APTs and some of the more advanced tactics that you're seeing, especially targeted at mobile. So obviously, like I mentioned at the start, you've covered a wide breadth of research from Lookout, from other mobile security companies. When you first heard about this particular discovery, what stood out to you as most interesting?
So there were a couple of things, just kind of following up what Apurva had mentioned. The first thing, in terms of the Android tools themselves that were being utilized, Silkbean stuck out to me here in that kind of a hallmark of the tool was its comprehensive RAT functionality. So it really enables an attacker to execute, I believe, over 70 different commands on an infected device. And that includes everything from collecting, modifying, sending messages, as well as recording the device screen and a couple of other, very invasive, malicious functionalities. I think another thing that really stuck out to me was the breadth and depth of this campaign. The fact that the attackers had used all these various malware tools, some of them of which hadn't even been discovered yet by the security research community, as well as with so many capabilities since at least 2013, that's pretty astonishing. And that really goes to show the level of obfuscation and detection sidestepping that was in place on the part of the actors. And I think the third thing too that stuck out to me was the victimology here, the Uyghurs, which is a Turkic minority ethnic group. And they have previously been targeted by various other spyware attacks, including a campaign that was seen as recently as June. I believe that was called the Action Spy campaign. So I think that this campaign really kind of paints a picture of just what a spyware attack really means in terms of how, in this case, minority groups, but in other cases, journalists or political dissidents are being targeted and what that really means at a human emotional level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, doing this in something so personal as a mobile device, it's emotional. It really gets into the what you do on a daily basis. And, you know, I think that one thing that I kind of want to talk about actually with everybody is we discover this stuff and it's cutting edge discovery. But why does it matter to me? Apurva, I'll direct this one at you. Where do you see the relationship between something like this discovery and what a CISO at, I don't know, a large bank is looking to protect against?
So there's two parts to that question, I guess. The first one would be, why would anyone care except if they weren't Uyghurs or Tibetans? There was another Uyghur targeted attack earlier this year. It's called Poison Carp, or Evil Eye, I think, was the one that was the name given to it by another company called Velexity. And that attack, what was most surprising part about it was the fact that exploits were publicly sitting on a website and they were indiscriminate. So you didn't have to be a Uyghur. If you visited that website, your device would be exploited and you would get some malware on your device. If you just access the right place, if you are, I don't know, interested in the Uyghur community and you happen to search for something and click on a website that you don't know about, your data could be uploaded to a server somewhere where someone else could look at it and be compromised. The second portion of that, which is the enterprise portion, is a really good one as well. So technically, if everybody's device can be compromised, then corporations should see that as a risk. People have personal devices and work devices, but some people use the same device for both. Or at the very least, they take in their personal device into the company premises. They connect it to the same Wi-Fi. So even if you do not really care about a person's personal device or your employee's personal information, that might be a potential hole that then works its way into your company. And then going back to the topic of rats, so remote access Trojans are basically malware that can execute any arbitrary command on an infected device, which means everything on the device is fair game. And if that device is connected to, say, a corporate VPN, that could be a pivot point that actors could use into your company, even if that was not the original intention. So yeah, I think those two aspects, I think everyone should be worried about it, whether you're a Uyghur or a Tibetan or not.
Right. It's actually really interesting you mentioned VPNs in particular. I mean, when everything shifted to remote work a few months ago with COVID-19, that was actually one of the things that we saw was people saying, well, the first thing I want to do is really invest in my VPN. But the fact is, to your point, people are relying a lot more on their personal devices to access corporate data. And with something like a Trojanized application, everything on the device is fair game. So, Kristen, do you want to tell us a little bit more about what it really means for an app to be Trojanized and why are they so dangerous beyond what Apurva was mentioning?
Yeah, so you know the history of the name, like a Trojan horse, a Trojanized application. It pretends to be a legitimate application to get past your guards for you to download, but it actually has malicious functionalities in it. We've seen several applications that pretend to be maybe an Android update app or a news application or something simple like that, that do actually take you to a legitimate news site, but in the background are secretly recording you, tracking your location, taking pictures. And so that's really crucial for an actor to have a functional app like that, because if you download an application onto your phone that all of a sudden crashes or doesn't work the first time you open it, you might get a little suspicious and try and remove it or uninstall it, versus if you actually download an application that works, it can stay on your phone for a longer period of time and spy on you. And so a lot of these applications that we found in this Chinese campaign that we wrote about were Trojanized surveillance applications. And I think back also to Apurva's point previously of why this is a corporate threat also, not just an individual threat. We saw that this campaign over the last 5+ years was targeting individuals in over 14 different countries, a lot of the times with very, you know, it did have specific titled applications that would be of interest to a very niche audience, but it did also have these generically branded, you know, Gmail or like blank applications that anyone might be interested in downloading. So if you're an international enterprise with employees in multiple different countries, or even just happen to be a company in one of these 14 countries, there is a very good chance that maybe, you know, what if one of your employees happened to download this Trojanized application, just get caught in the crossfire, you know, without even being a Uyghur target of interest.
It's funny to, not funny, but it's interesting to think that you can just happen across one of these things. I mean, yeah, they're used to target a certain population, but that doesn't mean that someone's not browsing an app store and suddenly come across this application. They think, oh, this looks great. They download it, and all of a sudden, they are now a victim of this campaign. But you can't see these apps that frequently on like the iOS App Store and Google Play Store. So, Kristen, I know that third-party app stores exist. Is that one of the ways that these apps were distributed?
Exactly. So that's a very good example for this campaign. You know, we didn't find these applications in legitimate Play Stores, but for countries like China, where Google Play does not exist, a lot of people are used to downloading their apps from third-party app stores. Or even you sometimes see little third-party sites popped up that aren't even official app stores, but people have APK downloads on there, or watering hole sites, which are sites specifically set up by an actor to look legitimate, to offer application downloads. So if you have a population that's used to downloading applications from an unofficial source, it would be a lot easier for them to then compromise their device and get infected if they just happen to download the wrong application from the wrong site.
It's interesting you talk about the watering hole sites, because one thing we see a lot of is mobile phishing, and people kind of traditionally think of phishing as you're getting an email from either someone who's posing as a, let's say, a C-level executive at your company asking you to wire the money, or the classic, you know, Nigerian prince scenario. But the fact is that a phishing link can have malicious intent beyond that and send you to one of those sites, right? And have you download one of those applications. Is that kind of a fair connection to make?
Yeah, so this has become a unique problem in the mobile space. The idea usually people have about phishing is, as you mentioned, the Nigerian prince. But on mobile, this becomes particularly interesting, and it becomes an issue that education around it hasn't gotten up to the mark quite yet. And there are certain things that just make it a little bit different. So on a mobile device, you cannot hover over a link. So if you have a link embedded within certain words in either an email or a message or something, you won't be able to hover over it to check where it's actually taking you. So let's say you click on it. Unless that's an exploit link, it's not going to actually do anything except take you to perhaps a familiar looking screen. But then once you go to that link, the full address bar on a mobile device is not visible. So you cannot actually check the usual checks that we have, like check the link that you're going to, make sure it's ending in the domain that you expect. That cannot happen anymore on a mobile device, especially if, so usually when you pick up and look at a message, you're probably doing something else. Maybe you're watching TV, or, you know, there's some loud music in the background, or somebody's caught your attention. Maybe your kids caught your attention or something. So your attention is diverted. And then you take a look at the device, and if the message is phrased correctly, comes at the right time, and is urgent enough, I can't imagine anyone not falling for that. I've fallen for it. I know many people have. It's just how it works. Social engineering is just so effective, and it's extremely effective on mobile devices. So the real takeaway from this whole situation is really just to be very careful about the links that you receive on a mobile device, understand how phishing can happen, that it's not only through email, it can happen through messages, it can happen through SMS, which we've seen very, very often.
Yeah, that's all spot on. And it really, like, well, you guys discovered, I remember earlier this year, wasn't you guys discovered that Canadian campaign that was using SMS to deliver fake links to people? And didn't, Apurva, didn't your husband get one of the links or something?
It started with my husband. Yeah. Yeah. He got it and he was like, hey, is this phishing? And I ended up having a look at that. And it just led to this wider investigation that we can actually talk about. And we got an insight into sort of an attacker's perspective on how these financially motivated attacks happen.
Absolutely. Always finding the good leads to dive into stuff. It's good stuff. So, Lindsay, you talk to so many organizations, and you talk to so many researchers. Education is a big part of it. Why else do you think it's important to publish reports like what Apurva and Kristen did a couple months ago?
Yeah, I would definitely agree that education is a huge part of this. Many of these cyber attacks stem from astoundingly simple attack vectors, whether it's kind of these simple phishing messages sent via email or even social media, as Apurva was mentioning, or, you know, third-party mobile app marketplaces like Kristen was talking about, or watering hole attacks or otherwise. And we're seeing in many cases that attackers are also raising the bar with their attacks and making them harder to detect or spot. And we've got that coupled with the ongoing pandemic and how, you know, attackers are playing on a lot of targets' motions with everything going on there. And I know, like, from my perspective, I've, you know, working in security over the years, become extremely paranoid. But I do know that many average consumers are barely aware of the basic security measures that they need to keep up with, whether it's, you know, regularly applying mobile updates or kind of the red flags to look out for in a malicious spear phishing email. And as Apurva was mentioning too, that's doubled and more trickier to detect when you're using your smartphone. So I think the education piece is big. Some of it too isn't even a lack of awareness, but kind of a lack of understanding about the potential impact that these attacks could have on our everyday lives. And I think that's why why, you know, this type of security research is so important. Just the understanding that minority groups or ethnic groups could be tracked and spied on by authorities, or beyond something at that extreme level, like something that could also extend to kind of the everyday person. If you look at examples like domestic abuse and stalkerware, and I think it's really important to understand kind of the potential impact here too. And one other point I want to make is the mobile threat is so big because we always have our smartphones with us. I think that this is also becoming extended with the increase in popularity of IoT, or the Internet of Things devices in our homes. And, you know, we now have smartwatches, we have, you know, surveillance cameras and connected doorbells set up in our homes. And these are all new ways for attackers to collect more personal and sensitive data about ourselves. So I just think that, you know, it's going to continue, and these types of sophisticated mobile attacks are not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you mentioned the extended environment of devices that we all have, especially now that we're all working from home. And the example I always think of when people mention IoT and smart devices, and correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it when Home Depot got breached a couple of years ago, wasn't it that the attacker got in through the smart side of like their HVAC system or something like that?
Right. Yeah, it was Target, I believe. And they got in through the HVAC system, which I don't believe that, you know, they at that time like realized or understood that this third party system could be a target. And now that definitely a way that caused a lot of damage to that corporation. So it is a good point.
Yeah, for sure. Going back to a little bit of kind of how this is all tied to businesses and more of the everyday, do we see, and Kristen, I'll ask you this. Do we see times when nation states do actually target corporations? Because it's not like it's just countries attacking other countries. I mean, do we see it where countries attack corporations as a way, as kind of a different way to maybe destabilize or mess with another country? Do we ever see that, Kristen?
Oh, absolutely. Another good example of a large nation state sponsored group is the Lazarus Group. You know, they were responsible for the 2014 attacks against Sony Pictures Entertainment. So just because you're a nation state doesn't necessarily mean you're only interested in targeting minorities or people who have dissenting opinions from your government. You know, you can go after corporations as well, because North Korea is a good example. They have a lot of sanctions against them, and they have state-sponsored cyber groups with financial motives to try and either steal money or Bitcoin or whatever it may be to help fund North Korea, essentially. And then also, I think something of interest is there's FireEye's digital quartermaster theory, which talks about how certain cyber groups might share malware. So essentially, there is one group who supplies a malicious tool set for more than one actor to use, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And from what I understand, that if you're the person supplying the sort of base malware for all that, that can be pretty lucrative. You mentioned, Kristen, some of the groups behind all this, and Apurva. I know that in the research, we talked a little bit about a connection to APT-15. They've done corporate espionage in the past, I'm pretty sure. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So what we found in our investigation was that we had a handful of indicators or domains or IP addresses that overlapped with previous activity of APT-15. APT-15 has been seen to target corporations around the world. Specifically, I think it was defense contractors in the UK at some point in 2013, and that was the connection that we were able to, one of those IOCs we were able to find that overlaps with the activity we were looking at. So it could be APT-15, but this also goes back to what Kristen was mentioning. We know lots of actors in that region actually overlap on a lot of IOCs. So what that tells us is they're basically using the same infrastructure or the same tool sets. And that tells us that even if an actor is not corporate focused or personal focused, they could have access to each other's data and each other's tools. So it's not odd for these actors to sort of blend into each other, use each other's tools and have access to each other's data simply because, you know, they're one big group.
Yeah, those indicators of compromise or those IOCs can definitely be a bit of a giveaway. So helpful for us. So before we kind of wrap things up here, maybe Lindsay, anything that you're working on right now that's particularly interesting or anywhere people can find and follow your work?
Yeah, for all of the listeners, you can find my work on threatpost.com. We generally cover threat intel, security vulnerabilities, and everything cybersecurity related. And definitely love covering kind of mobile related security. I would say one interesting thing that I recently covered was a researcher who came forth to talk about how he developed a kill switch exploit for a flaw in Emotet, which caused Emotet to crash and prevented it from infecting systems for 6 months. In case anyone was wondering why Emotet has been gone since February and recently returned in August. So that was kind of a cool story to cover. But beyond that, yeah, we love to cover all things, you know, different types of threat intel. So, you know, definitely visit threatpost.com. And I'm also on Twitter at LindsayOD123.
Cool. Awesome. And yeah, we'll make sure to share that out, your handle. And then obviously I think most people listening to this know Threat Post pretty well. But yeah, Lindsay, you've been a fantastic collaborator, there we go, with us over the years. You've always put out great content. So I definitely encourage everybody to give her a follow, check her out on Threat Post, on Twitter, all of that. So Lindsay, it's been awesome to chat with you. And Kristen, thank you for coming on. You're on Twitter as well, right?
Yep, pretty boring handle. It's just Kristen Doloroso, all one word. But yeah, long in there, but I'm on it. Lurker more than poster.
Got it. Well, at least it's not your AOL Instant Messenger screen name from eighth grade or something like that. So Apurva, thank you as well for joining the podcast. You're on Twitter too, right? Just like everybody else?
Yeah. Thanks, Hank, for having us. My Twitter handle is at Abby_KCS.
Cool. And we'll add all of these handles and whatnot to the description of the podcast once we put it up. But one last thing that I'll pop in there myself is that the Lookout Threat Team, which Kristen and Apurva are members of, obviously, just started a dedicated Twitter account, which will be at Lookout Threats. There we'll be sharing pretty periodically small and large discoveries we make. Something like what we talked about today is pretty large scale, but we'll definitely be talking a little bit more about maybe some of the smaller things. It's all pretty interesting stuff. Personally, I get to do a lot of work with them, and I really enjoy it. Hope you feel the same way when you follow us on Lookout Threats. You can also subscribe to Endpoint Enigma wherever you get your podcasts, and find more security content at the Lookout blog, which is just blog.lookout.com. And I'm going to wrap up all the plugs there, assuming anybody's listened through the end of it. We appreciate having you. It's been a pleasure to talk to all three of you, Lindsay, Kristen, and Apurva. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next time.